Securities and advisory services through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered broker-dealer and investment advisor. Member FINRA, SIPC.
Connecticut. As a 37-year veteran of the securities industry, one may surmise I've gathered a fair amount of insight into money, marriage, stocks, ETFs, mutual funds, kids, spending, college, monetary policy, politics, love, life, vacations, faith, relationships, faith, hope, and credit cards. A little background to those who don't know me. I grew up in Staten Island attending Catholic schools. My dad was an Irish immigrant from County Roscommon, which back in the day they called sheep stealers. Don't ask me why, I don't know. If you wanted to rile him up in later years, just say that word, and he would get mad. Mom grew up in the Bronx from immigrant parents from, you guessed it, Ireland. I was the oldest of six, attending college at Oneonta State, and right on to Binghamton for an MBA. Graduating in 1980, my friend Jay Richmond, dad Mike, got me an interview with a small firm that specialized in municipal bonds. 1980, and many of you weren't even born yet, including the gentleman sitting right across from me at the radio station. What year were you born? 92. All right. So anyway, for 2 years, I sold municipal bonds, learned all about them. They were happy to teach the goyim all they knew, and I was willing and eager student. Talk about characters. I love that place. I still think of them often. The technology was very, very different back in the day. We were talking about blackboards and erasers and bond offerings coming up, and it was a wonderful time. But I knew the firm was too small to flourish. And in 82, I went to work for a larger firm in the bond department, basically institutional sales. I sold bonds to trust departments all across the Midwest and traveled a lot. In 1986, I moved to Mystic, worked for a small regional firm out of Hartford called Advest as a retail broker for 17 years, later joining a national wirehouse for 9 years before striking out on my own about 3 years ago as an independent. My goal with this hour on the radio is to help people take control of their retirement, whether they're 35 or 85. I have a process that's helped many people, and I want to share it with you over the next few weeks. Also, taking questions from the phones to see what's on your mind. My wife and I put 3 sons through college, and I want to share my insights with you on those decisions. I will share with you stories and narratives of people I've worked with to help them get them to their goals. Also, I've seen some of the mistakes people have made with their money. And we'll also discuss what we could have done differently with the benefit of the rearview mirror, of course. What I really love to have is older retirees call in and tell us how they're doing, what they did well, and what they would have done a little bit differently if they had the choice. Sometimes it's better to hear it from the source. Tell me what it was like when the phone stopped ringing and you had to get reacquainted with your spouse. How was your cash flow changed, and how was your relationship with money changed? How did you change your behavior and your spending? Were there fights or disagreements? Did it cause friction? I would like this hour to be a conduit in which we help each other cope with money issues that arise, not depend on providers which may or may not have their own agenda. Media financial commentary helpful, or do you get your advice from family members, friends, or neighbors? I'd like to open up the phones if anybody would like to call in. And my trusty producer is going to give me the phone number because I am new to this and learning as we go. One of the things I want to share with you is I recently, my son got married in Budapest last week, and we were in Europe, and we drove around Germany and Austria. And as we drove around, I looked and talked to a lot of Germans, what's going on in Europe. And I like to get things anecdotally from friends and family when I'm traveling, talk to people actually, you know, that actually have something to say. You can call in at 860-464-1499-9490, the worst nines I've ever seen in the history of radio, or 631-317-1949. 860-464-9490. Feel free to call in with your retirement stories, what you did well and what you wish you'd done differently. I'd like to hear those stories and talk to you about it. Just getting back to Europe. We went to Europe for 9 days, and my son got married in Budapest. He works in Manhattan for NBC. Met a very nice girl there who's been here for 10 years. And her dad wanted to, of course, walk her down the aisle, and they live outside Budapest. So we flew into Budapest and had a beautiful wedding right across from the Chain Bridge. There's a Four Seasons hotel right there. And it really, really was an amazing, amazing journey because we got to see what an Iron Curtain country, what was going on. When the curtain came down in 91, 92, they had had no reinvestment. They had had no companies started. Everything was controlled by the government. The Russians dominated. And in 91 and 92, when the wall came down, all of a sudden these people were like, what are we going to do now? And so slowly but surely, the Hungarians are starting companies. They're having companies move in. It's not a fast process. It takes a long, long time. But you can see the fact that they are starting to come back from that. And it's going to take a couple of generations for people to learn entrepreneurship and the idea of being able to make money and start companies and do things like that. We spent 3 days there, and after the wedding, we took off for Germany, and we drove down the Austrian Autobahn, and my wife was an Air Force brat. My father-in-law was with us. He's 84 years old, and we drove into a place called Berchtesgaden. We have a couple calls? Okay. We have a two-minute warning. Sorry about that. And I'll tell you about Berchtesgaden and what happened there. It is the home of the Eagle's Nest, which is the fortress on the hill that Hitler built. And I talked to Germans from that area, and I'll also relate some stories about dealing with German waiters, which are a breed apart. I was shocked by their difference from American waiters, and I have a newfound. I've been over tipping ever since I got home, I'll be right honest with you, because American waiters and waitresses are wonderful compared to Germany. But I'll talk about that a little bit about the trip, and then we'll go into some other things that's going on over there economically, the things I noticed about the immigrants and transits over there. And we'll talk about some of the conversations I had with people over there and some of the things that have gone on. The other thing I'm going to talk about is we're going to talk about the millenniums. Among other things, we're going to talk about interest rates, stocks, portfolios, planning. And if you need to reach me during the week and you want to talk about your situation, my number is 860-415-9614. 860-415-9614 or www.obrienretired.com. Thank you. And off we go in how long, my friendly producer man? Connecticut. I was talking about my recent trip to Europe. My son had got married in Budapest, and we drove to Germany, and we stayed at a place called Berchtesgaden. My wife knew about it from her days as a child traveling with her Air Force dad in the early 60s. And so I went along for the ride. I was curious to see the countryside and whatnot. And Berchtesgaden is the place, the town where when Hitler, things were falling apart for him, all his senior officers moved to that town, built houses. And on top of a large hill, he built something called the Eagle's Nest, which is this large fortress that has become a huge tourist attraction to the German people and people, of course, around the world. But it was probably, I'd say, 80% German nationals that were at the thing. The large living room where Eva, his lover, whatever you called her, there's actually a tourist cafeteria there now. So we were literally eating 10 feet away from the fireplace where Eva Braun used to sit waiting for Adolf to come back. And it was made out of Italian marble that was rumored to be donated by Mussolini, the fascist dictator of Italy. And we're sitting there, and the Germans are drinking drafts of beer, eating racks of whatever, Wiener Schnitzel, and we're sitting around, and I thought it was a pretty surreal experience myself. You drive up there, and you park probably a half a mile away. You buy your ticket. You get in this bus. You get in this bus, and you drive up to a circular parking area. And you, when you get out, there's a long, long tunnel. I'd say, I'd say probably 200 to 300 yards long, deep into the mountain. So we walk down the tunnel. Of course, you got to wait, and you're waiting for the elevator, which took probably about 50 people at a time, and it's the original elevator from what they told me. I found a curious outside elevator. It said Otis on it. So I don't know if Otis eventually redid it with the original suppliers. But it was fascinating to get on. You go up, and the views, of course, are magnificent. But walking around the Eagle's Nest and seeing how the German people treat it as a curiosity more, a reminder to them, what can happen if nationalism and dictatorship and take over. And it was sobering to watch, but fascinating to see. We get back to the hotel. We stayed at a place called Edelweiss Hotel, which, you know, Edelweiss is the national flower. It's everywhere as a symbol in Austria. Austrians are quite proud of their heritage. And their economy's booming. I have to handle. I saw cranes everywhere in southern Germany and Austria. They're doing very, very well. And the Bavarians, with their white and blue flags, are extremely proud of that. The hotel had, of course, you'd stop to eat and everything else. And the German waiters, I have to say, were probably some of the worst I've ever had in the world. My wife and her sister are the picky types. They like to, what's this? What's that? Could you cook it like this? Could I get extra ice? No, no, the German waiter would yell back at them, literally yelling and back at them. And they'd look at me, and I just start laughing because I said, well, what in Germany? Do as the Germans, right? So after a while, I remember like 2 or 3 days of this, we wound up in Vienna, and I turned to my wife and I said, sweetheart, can I act German? She says, "Here, go ahead." So in the middle of the cafe in downtown Vienna, I yelled out, "More apple strudel! More apple strudel!" And the waiters came running, and they started waiting on us. And they looked at me, and I go, "What's going on?" I said, "Well, if you act kind and nice, they see that as a sign of weakness. If you act demanding and strong, they respect that and come running." And I hope American waiters and waitresses don't catch on to that, because it would be absolutely terrible. The other thing about Europe was, we talked about the cranes everywhere. It was really an amazing thing to see. Their infrastructure is very good. The highways, the autobahns. Unlike in Austria, be very careful to get on the highway, because they claim, you think it's unlimited speed, but it isn't. It's 130 kilometers per hour is the top speed. And the signs say 100 with a little round red thing on it. Slow down, because they have cameras everywhere. I'm very, very scared Hertz is going to send me a big bill for speeding, because I did not know that, and I'm probably screwed. Can I say that on the radio? But I probably am. I just hope it's under a few $100, but we'll wait and see. If anybody's been to Austria and knows the deal with renting a car and not knowing the rules, feel free to call in and give me the bad news, because I am very, very afraid of what's coming here. But the trip was fascinating. I did talk to a German lady on the bus up to the Eagle's Nest. She told me, she says, listen, she goes, we have a very bad history. That's the way she put it. She says, we're very, very scared of nationalism. We almost go overboard with helping other countries, because we almost look at it as reparations and guilt and whatnot. I saw migrants everywhere from the Middle East, everywhere. Vienna, everywhere. Salzburg, and even at the Ipsy Hotel, which is in a remote part of Austria, actually southern Germany, around the lake, which is beautiful. There were migrants camped everywhere around the lake. And it was just like, you know, it's happening, and it's there, and it's real. So it was very interesting to watch. And now we're going to talk about, I think we're going to talk about what's going on right now over here as we come back. It's been an interesting period here. We've had about $30 billion go out of the stock market in the last 6 weeks. Some money came back in last week. Thursday was a real interesting day. It was very, very strong across the board, and we hadn't seen that for probably a couple of months. So it was nice to see. The big thing for retirees, and a lot of questions retirees have, is what's going to happen with interest rates? Are interest rates going to go back up? Are we ever going to see the interest rates we saw in the 1980s and the 1990s? I remember when I first started in the business in 1980. My first car loan in 1981 was at 18.9%. 18.9%. Now, if you pay anything, and if you pay now, if you pay more than 0%, you're not getting the incentives that you used to get. So, right now we're looking at interest rates, at the bank, very, very low. You can get a mortgage at 3 to 4%. CDs, you're lucky if you get 1%. But, we do have a call. Sam from Westerly, Rhode Island. Sam, go ahead. Well, how can
I
help you?
Sam from Westerly here. Hey, I hate to get off on this particular foot at the moment, but you are getting into a political area, and several times now you keep saying nationalism, nationalism that you seem to be fearing here, but you put it in context of the area in which you're speaking. It's nationalist socialists that was the German politics that became so horrendous.
Yes, yes. The lady spoke of nationalism in terms of being worried about Germany dominating its neighbors again, not only economically but militarily.
But once again, you know, it's National Socialists, and they had central control of everything, and as opposed to these days, how can I say, globalism seems to be keeping our borders, language, and culture diluted and open, where we're losing those borders, language, and culture.
Yes, yes, yes. She wasn't talking about that. That is a totally different topic. I'm talking about from the German point of view, just talking to a normal citizen. Whether I agreed with her or not, I wanted to hear what she had to say.
Okay.
You know what
Thank
I'm saying?
You.
You're welcome, sir.
As long as you put that nationalism with National Socialist.
Right, right. This is strictly from the German point of view and one person.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Sam. Thank you for
God
calling
bless.
In. God bless
Bye-bye.
You, sir. Yeah, it's interesting. You know, you hit certain hot topics when you talk about politics and whatnot. The Germany situation, let's just go back to that and the rise of socialism and what became of what happened there. And I did a fair amount of reading on it before we left. And, you know, the 1920s in our country and around the world were a boom period, absolute boom period. We had the rise of the automobile, the rise of the stock markets. We had factories opening up. Henry Ford was opening up factories left and right. We had the rise of a middle class, and it all come crashing down in the late 90s, probably late 20s, because things just got overly extended. There was too much, too fast, and the markets eventually crashed. One of the things that happened in Germany during that period was the Germans after World War II printed a lot of money. They had a lot of inflation. You heard the stories about buckets of money going to buy a loaf of bread, the things that are happening in Venezuela right now. And we saw the rise of inflation. Eventually the Germans figured that out, but the reparations that were demanded after World War I were incredibly harsh on the German people. But even the German economy was starting to come back in the late 1920s. And when the markets crashed, we had, there was basically a, Germany was affected by a tremendous amount like we all were. But the thing that really put Germany into the vise was the Smoot-Hawley laws that restricted. There were tariffs going up in both directions, and World War Trade went to a halt. And in Hamburg, their main shipping area, unemployment went from 5 to 45% within the period of 2 to 3 years. So when Hitler and his socialist group got in 1932, it was because the German people were pissed off. They were pissed off that they had been beaten up in the early 20s. They had come back, and now it was happening all over to them. And so they voted this guy in, and then, he started guns, and what happened was the economy got better, and I saw the pictures of him around the country and hidden away in spots and in antique stores and everything else, but it led to an absolute horrible time and tens of millions of people being killed. Bad economic policy can lead to war, and that's something that every child should learn in school, but unfortunately sometimes those issues pass. So we're coming up on commercial time. We're going to talk about something boring called interest rates in the next topic, among other things. And please stay with me, and we'll be back. Bye-bye. And now we're going to talk about some case studies and things in retirement. Anybody who's gone through retirement, call in and tell us what you did right and what you did wrong and what you'd do over again. One of my topics I talked about with clients is stock in a 401k. If you have company stock in a 401k, some people say it's the greatest thing they ever did. They must own GD. And some people say it's the most horrible thing they ever did, and they must own WorldCom or Lucent or something like that. It presents special challenges for people, and it's something we'll talk about a little bit later. I want to talk about one case study where a healthcare professional had worked at 7 or 8 different hospitals, came in, and she was so nervous to see me, she ran into the bathroom next to the office, and I heard some very strange sounds coming out of there before we sat down and talked. She's what I call a money phobic. She was a very good saver, divorced, but very, very scared about really dealing with and talking about it. And she claimed it came from her dad, because anytime her dad talked about money, he was usually screaming. And I think it passed on to the young girl as growing up in the household. And so when she actually came to me to see me, she was, she had some things we needed to fix. And, first of all, we did an inventory of everything she had. She went through her debts. She had a special needs son that needed some help, and we had to go through. She had some college debts we needed to deal with. And we needed to, she didn't really know what she owned in these 7 or 8 401ks. So I thought it would be a good idea for her in particular to consolidate those debts, consolidate those 401ks into an account where we could track and manage and whatnot. And it took us about a year to do. We got the debts paid down. We got our credit cards paid off. We got a lot of things taken care of. We dealt with our house. And now she is one of the happiest people I know, because she is now living worry-free. More importantly, she has someone to talk to and say, what do you think of this? What do you think of that? I heard this. I heard that. And many times the advice we get from friends, family, coworkers, associates is wrong. It's just, it's not good advice. It's something you got to be very, very careful about. I'm getting a lot of calls these days about marijuana stocks. Should I buy into marijuana stocks? And I've had personal experience with medical marijuana. We had a boy in town in Mystic who had seizures for years, and I urged the parents, let's look at medical marijuana after seeing some of those documentaries from Colorado. And it was a miracle what happened to this boy. He hasn't had a seizure, and the miracle marijuana has worked magically. But how do you turn that into an investment? It's very, very difficult, because the growers are a dime a dozen. The distributors are not really out there yet, because we don't have nationwide distributorships. So it's a very tricky, you have some companies that are working on the molecules that are similar, and if they could get FDA approval for the molecules that work and actually have patent protection on that, then you have something. But that area is going to be very, very tricky to invest in, and wait to see. I'm also getting calls on cryptocurrencies, which is a very strange area. All the 20 and 30-year-olds are probably shaking their head going, yeah, I know what that is. I know what Bitcoin is. I know what Ethereum is and all that. And that's a whole other area that seems to be exploding, but it's very tricky, because we don't know who's going to dominate that area. We don't know if there'll be government control over that area. We don't even know if that cryptocurrency stuff is safe from hackers yet. And so we're seeing the headlines, and you're going to see a lot on it. There's rumors there's going to be an ETF, which is a fund that has all the cryptocurrency companies in it, or the actual currencies themselves, but we just don't know. So I get a lot of calls on a lot of different things, and I look at them, but at the same time, extremely cautious, because be very, very careful. Retirement is basically all about cash flow. You know, you have to know your cash flows in and out. If you spend $4,000 a month, and that's your monthly nut, or $6,000, or $2,000, or $12,000 a month is your monthly nut, is what you live on. You got to figure out whether you can continue to live on that after you retire. You got to work longer, you work longer. If you go to www.obrienretired.com, you can ask for my retirement 10 commandments, secrets, whatever you want to call them. And in that, I'll talk about the 10 things you should consider before you retire. Just put in your email, you put in your phone if you want. I only call you once and say, hey, listen, you want to talk again, let me know. Because I am it. I am the person you would talk to, either me or my wife. So we can go from there. The big thing is, when you go to retire, my number one rule, what's the number one rule, if anybody would like to guess, is no debt. And I fight over my mortgage banker friends, fight with me. My reverse mortgage friends tell me otherwise, but I see situations where people retire and they have credit card debt, they have mortgage debt, they have debt on boats, they have debt on cars, and I tell them, listen, you can't retire until you pay off your debt. I don't care if you have to sell your house and buy a smaller house. Who wants stairs anyway in your house when you go to retire? But that's the number one rule, is no debt. And I'll tell you a story. One couple came into my office, retired state worker, and she was an entrepreneur. He had a very good pension, as you might imagine, from the state. She wanted to keep working, so they had a nice joint income still coming in, and he was going to still work. He was in his late 50s. He was going to start something else as a 1099 employee and hustle that and everything else. And everything looked good. The house, the kids' college is paid for. The credit cards were going to be paid off, not to be used anymore, everything else. There was only one problem. He's 58 and she's 57. They had $250,000 still owed on the house. And the house was worth, $350,000, $400,000. And I looked at them and I said, you can't retire. And he looked at me and he goes, well, I could. I go, you can, but that $3,000 a month mortgage that you're paying on, you would need another job paying about $50,000 a year after taxes you would actually give yourself a raise of $50,000 a year pre-tax if you didn't have that mortgage. So get rid of the mortgage. So the goal is, we all sat down, we worked it out. He's going to work the second job. We're going to take all the revenues from the second job and use that to pay off the mortgage. So they'll be totally debt-free when he goes. So maybe at 63, and then, of course, they can decide whether they want to move, to wherever. Seems like nobody stays in Connecticut after they retire anymore, because of the high property taxes and whatnot. So that's a case study. No debt. It's something that I kind of stress. Of course, people are going to do whatever they want to do, but it's something I feel very, very strongly about. I've seen the people do it with debt, and they survive, but it's a lot easier and a lot less stress if you go to retire with no debt. And it's something that please make your phone calls. Feel free to call in. And he gave me the number, and I got to read his bad nines again, but it's 860-464-9490, 860-464-9490, or 631-317-1949, 631-317-1949. Now, I touched briefly on property taxes, and it's something that has puzzled me for a long time. I moved to Connecticut 30 years ago, and I never understood why each town, and there's 169 of them in Connecticut, had their own property tax, had their own taxing system, and I didn't know how that whole thing had evolved. And I was fascinated to learn. Somebody took me through, I don't know if it was a history professor or someone at the Historical Society took me through it, and explained to me that Connecticut's history was based on the fact that each church, each pilgrim church, what was it, a congregational parish, used to be able to tax everybody in that town because everybody was congregationalist back in the day in the 1600s, 1700s. So each town in Connecticut has a congregational church that used to have the taxing power. And that is so different from what we're separation of church and state, but America, before really America was born, that was not the case. It was a religious country and basically one religion at the time, which was Congregationalist. I mean, there were other sects, of course, Anglican and whatnot. But so each town, and I think it was 1822 or whatever year that was knocked out. But each town remained. Each parish became the town, became a taxing authority. And that's how it evolved in Connecticut, where we have all these little fiefdoms throughout the state. And what that has led to, huge disparities in property taxes, which is affecting us dramatically right now, because a lot of the retirees, that is their biggest expense. That you can't, if you live down in Grand Long Point, or you live down in Old Saybrook, and you're near the water, and you've retired, and you're looking at $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, $30,000 a year tax bill, that's a big deal. That's like a huge mortgage on the house. So we'll talk about that a little bit further as we go on in the show. We have how much time left in this segment here? About 30 seconds left. And we'll also talk about, I think we'll talk about ETFs, which is a favorite topic of mine. A lot of people don't even know what that means, but we'll talk about that and how they can benefit you. In any case, when we get back, if you have any questions, feel free to call in 464-9490. And thank you very much. Now, how to keep going. We have a change of plans. He's told me we can keep going. All right, let's go back to property taxes a second, because that is the biggest bill that our retirees face here in Connecticut in many cases. I mean, you have state taxes. You have, of course, sales taxes, especially a big-ticket item if you buy a car or something big like that. But real estate taxes, property taxes, mill rates are very, very very interesting topic the way Connecticut does it, and I'd like to talk about a little bit further. Do you know that the mill rate, and people in New York, I'm sorry, but if you don't know what a mill rate is, it is basically the percentage of tax per thousand, you know. So if you have a 20 mil rate, it's $20 per thousand. So if your house is 300,000, Connecticut law is 70% of value, 210, you're at 20, you're going to pay $20 per 21, which is, you know, $4,200 a year. That's your mill rate. That's your rate per thousand. And in New York, they do it a little bit differently. New York City has a very interesting way of doing it, but we'll talk about that later. In Connecticut, do you know that the highest mill rate is Hartford? And Hartford's unique that they have a bifurcated rate. one for residential, which is in the low 30s, and one for commercial, which is in the high 70s, which is an extremely high mill rate. The lowest mill rate in the state is, guess which town? Greenwich, Connecticut. Who would have thunk it, right? But Greenwich, Connecticut has an 11 and change mill rate. So to give, put that in context, New London's around 44. Groton's around, well, with the fire districts, I would guess around 25, 26. Stonington's a little bit less. Westerly, Rhode Island is probably just under 20. I think it's a little cheaper, and some of the young families are moving over there because of that. Mill rates matter, and I'll tell you why. They affect things long-term in every town and every city, and there's a book out. If you're fascinated by what mill rates do, what real property taxes can do to encourage or discourage development in your town, just read a book called Boomtowns by Professor Stephen Walters. He's University of, I think it's University of Maryland, Loyola. And Dr. Walters and myself have spoken many, many times. He tells me it's hopeless, nobody will change, but at the same time, it's good to understand what's going on. If you buy a, house in a low tax, under 15 mil, chances are that town's doing well, businesses are moving in. From 15 to 30, I've noticed that it's more neutral, the town won't boom or bust. But if there's a town at 28 and there's another town at 18 close by, people will look at the 18 and go and move there to the 28. Once you get over 30 in your mill rate, which is most if not all the cities except Danbury in Connecticut, very, very hard to have new businesses move in. Very, very difficult. Now people think this is political, but it isn't. It's just strictly mathematical. It's strictly how it works. People think with their pocketbook. They think with their purse. They want to be in towns where they figure that the mill rate, will be fair and honest and whatnot. And Dr. Walters, talked about this, and the reason I'm talking about it is because it's affecting retirees here. It has a huge effect on retirees, where they decide to live, what they decide to do. Then it creates budget deficits if they choose to leave, and besides that, it can create higher taxes for everyone who else remains. So if you think it doesn't affect you, you are very sadly mistaken, because it does. So in any case, he's telling me I got 1 minute to the break, and and I'm following my lead here, but I like to talk about that. I think we've talked enough about mill rates and real estate taxes, but it has a huge effect what town you live in and how much you're paying, and it affects your resale of your home too if the mill rates go up dramatically, unfortunately. But we'll talk about too. We're also going to talk about interest rates, because everything comes off of interest rates. How much you earn at the bank, how much you borrow. Are we being forced to taking risk in our 401ks and our IRAs, in our savings because of these low interest rates? How long are they going to last? Is this a phenomenon that is never going to go away? I have some thoughts on that I want to talk about. I read everything, I look at everything, but, I've never been in a situation, 37 years, I've never seen a situation like this. To my millennium friends out there born between, 82 and 02, this will not last, but eventually they will rise to more normal levels, but I don't know when, and nobody does. So we'll talk about that also, because this is a big effect on you. But enjoy those 3-4% mortgages, because, back in the early 80s, mortgage rates were, 13, 14, 15%. And it killed the housing market for that time being. That was part of the thing they wanted to do, was kill inflation that had spewed in the 70s. And when Reagan came in, he let Volcker do it, and Volcker raised the rates, and they cut the top rate in taxes, and we had a boom period for a while. So in any case, we'll talk about some of that too. But in any case, are we going to break now, or are we going to wait a minute? Okay, we're going to go right now, and we'll get back to you. Thank you. We'll be right back. America. I hope everybody's doing well. Let's just talk about interest rates a little bit. I know it's a boring topic, and nobody really likes to talk about interest rates and whatnot, but they affect so much of everything you go to do financially and everything else. Right now, all the portfolios I'm dealing with are income starved. Everybody's trying to find income, and it's making people do things they normally wouldn't do and buy into areas like high yield and these business investment vehicles. I see all these things. I truly don't understand why someone, especially in a retirement age, would buy and everything else. But the key to the portfolio, especially retirees, is cash flow. And if cash flow is the key, then the key is to get income coming in while you're retired. Now, I basically run three styles, a very low risk, and I target a 3% current payout, but the total risk is, of course, greater because you're buying investments. So bear that in mind. Anything I talk about is not CDs or banks. These are investments, and they can go up and down. Your statements change in value a little bit every month. It's just part of what it is. Moderate risk portfolios, if you're looking for current income flow, I'm targeting 5.5-6. It's getting harder and harder because the rates and everything's getting cut. It just seems like this worldwide deflation is just putting a giant blanket on everything, and the rates just keep coming down and down and down and down. And we're going to talk about that a little bit. High risk, it used to be 9, now 8-9, because once again, the rates are coming down, and these portfolios, they can change your value quite a bit, because you're dealing with REITs, real estate investment trusts, you're dealing with MLP funds. These are all indexes funds. I don't buy things individually, but I'm looking for income, income, income. And many times when I get a new investor, I try to gauge the risk tolerance, and then 3, 6, or 9 is, you know, we go that route and everything else. The second part of the portfolios is, I call them millennium stocks. And the millenniums are going to have a huge effect. They're a larger group now than the baby boomers. You baby boomers, take a step back, because you are not king of the hill anymore. These kids are. Look at your kids. Look at your grandchildren. Their buying patterns, the way they buy things on the internet, the way they relate to each other through social media, the way they drive, the way they're going to live. Are they going to live in little houses? We don't know. I mean, are they going to want to use electricity, or how are they going to live, affects everything. And I'm seeing a huge shift in the stock market in terms of, you know, you see the press with the retailers. The traditional bricks and mortar retailers have been going down, and what's been rising? The Amazons of the world, the Wayfairs, my kid comes up with new names. He's 23, 24. He works for an internet company in New York. He comes on, you ever hear this one, Dad? You ever hear that one? I go, no, but you please tell me about it. And I'll leave you with one story, because I know this segment's a little shorter because we had a computer glitch at the quarter hour last time around. I was in an Irish bar in Mystic. I forget the name of it, and Leo Roche is going to be mad at me. And basically, my father-in-law were at a horse farm fundraiser for horses that put out the pasture. And I sat there at the bar, and the bar was full of millenniums. And I looked over at Mrs. Roche, and I said, what's that on the thing? She said, that's 30 debit cards, credit cards. I go, what are they doing there? She goes, oh, these kids, they don't carry cash. They just put their debit or credit card on the register on the bar, and they run a tab. I go, what? Because I'm thinking scammers. I'm thinking somebody's going to take a picture. You know, I was raised where, you know, cash, keep it in your front pocket in a crowd. You know, I mean, call me an old goat, but that's what I am. So I left the bar that night. I started thinking, wait a minute. There's all those millenniums are running things through the transaction systems of Visa, MasterCard. Though, if cash is not being used, then you better keep an eye on these. So that gives you an example of what the millenniums are bringing to the table. Is these kids are looking at things differently, and my portfolios and millennium stocks, I'm adjusting to it because I can see that this is a big revolution that's coming. We'll talk more in the coming weeks about different things that are coming. I'll also talk next time about tactical things I like to do, and we'll talk about three favorite ideas I've had in the last 3 months. In any case, it's been really good talking to everybody. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have, and I look forward to getting each of you, get to know each of you much better. You can reach me during the week at 860-415-9614 or www.obrienretire.com. Thank you very much. And let's cue the Allman Brothers, Jessica, and one of the songs I grew up with, and I know I'm dating myself. But thank you very much. Take care.